Good evening. Thank you for coming tonight. My name is Kate Daniels, and on behalf of all of my colleagues in the creative writing, on the creative writing faculty here at Vanderbilt, I'm pleased to welcome you to the first reading in this year's Gertrude and Harold S. Vanderbilt Visiting Writers Series. Our guest this evening is poet Robin Becker, and as I said, thank you all for coming. Robin Becker comes to us from Pennsylvania, where she is a professor of English and Women's Studies at the Pennsylvania State University. She's been there, I think, about 15 years now. Before that, she was on the faculty also for a good number of years at MIT in their program in Writing and Humanistic Studies. She was born and raised in Philadelphia and did both her graduate and undergraduate work at Boston University. Robin Becker is the author of 7 volumes of poetry, ranging from Personal Effects, which came out from Alice James Press in 1977, to most recently Domain of Perfect Affection, which came out with a selection in the very eminent University of Pittsburgh Poetry Series, came out in 2006, just last year. A number of her books, I think 4 of them, are available for purchase after the reading tonight, right outside, courtesy of our Vanderbilt University bookstore. So I hope you will hang around a little bit after the reading and have some refreshment, buy some books, and talk to Robin Becker and ask her to inscribe them for you. She'll be glad to do that. In addition to poetry, Robin Becker writes critical review essays on contemporary and women's poetry. And she serves as the poetry editor and also columnist for the Women's Review of Books, which is headquartered up at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Her work has been widely recognized for its excellence over the years, garnering fellowships and awards from many different organizations and foundations, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the Lambda Literary Foundation, Harvard University's Bunting Institute, the Massachusetts Artists Foundation, the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at City University of New York, the Frick Art and Historical Center in Pittsburgh, the William Steeple Davis Visual Arts Foundation, just a really marvelous award she told me about last night, a whole year of living free in this mansion, the William Steeple Davis Mansion, and I'm coveting that, and the Pennsylvania State University, which recently awarded her its Atherton Award for Excellence in Teaching. She teaches at Penn State in the graduate MFA program in creative writing, as well as in the undergraduate programs. I have read Robin Becker's poetry and essays for many years now, but she was one of the poets whose work I admired and was particularly interested in, but had not ever met until last spring when she approached me after a conference in Atlanta where I had been on a panel. She came up to me afterwards and introduced herself. And when my colleague Mark Jarman joined us a few moments after we had met and was introduced, both of us found ourselves as immediately delighted by Robin Becker in the flesh as we had been for many years in reading her poems. And we invited her right on the spot, please come to Vanderbilt and read some poems for us. And so here she is this evening. She's been here actually throughout the entire weekend. She's been meeting our students, particularly our graduate students. She's had dinner with them. We've taken them around to see some of the sites in Nashville. She attended the graduate poetry workshop this afternoon and workshopped everyone. And now we are to have the pleasure of hearing her read some of her poems to us. Robin Becker's poems have always struck me as having about them, and I hope this won't take her aback or worry her, but having about them a sense of what I've always called to myself a certain kind of restlessness. Formally, her poems present on the pages as well wrought, as very carefully, very beautifully made. She makes very striking choices in diction, and she has a particularly marvelous ear for catching colloquialisms, and for a certain kind, and for representing a certain kind of Yiddish-influenced American English. Still, despite the carefully created linguistic surfaces of her poems, they bristle with a restless inner energy that seems to balk at the containment of the forms themselves, longing to leap out at us from the page, escaping what I might call their static confinement. There is something very dynamic on the interior of her poems that is constantly interrogating the formal choices that the poet has made. and this ripe tension between form and content makes them, to me, and I'm sure to you as well, very compelling to read and very memorable. I was struck in reading a recent poem, a poem from her most recent volume, at these lines. The artist understood the swoon of doctrine, its fundamental musculature, and the human need to lean against the lusty form. I thought those lines, in many ways, articulate what I've been trying to express to myself about the energies that hold together, the restless energies, I might say, that hold together Robin Becker's poems and that make me appreciate them in a particular way. Becker's poems range over many settings and locations. Again, something that gives them a sense of restlessness to me. Entering deeply into the private lives of many different characters, both real and invented, to expose inner worlds that have been made chaotic by a painful disjunction between the personal self and the public world in which that personal self finds it necessary to exist. While the poems show us the chaos and unpredictability of human life, there are also moments of wonderful humor in them, and even more, there are moments of wonderful tenderness and the appreciation of beauty. In particular, her poems have explored with great intensity identity issues related to gay and lesbian and Jewish identities. The struggle at the heart of her poems, I think, is not a struggle to make meaning. Many of us and many poets over time have struggled to make meaning out of a world that seems to resist, or reality, or, you know, the perceptions of reality that seem to resist meaning. But I think her struggle is not in these poems to make meaning. Instead, it seems to me to be a struggle to create a clearing, to try to cultivate some kind of orderly space in which the personas who inhabit her poems might feel at home with themselves, finally, and with what the world calls their difference. I think you'll enjoy hearing these poems, and it's a pleasure to have Robin Becker with us here at Vanderbilt this evening, so please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you, Kate, for that lovely introduction. I want to thank Professors Kate Daniels and Mark Jarman for inviting me here to Vanderbilt and hosting this visit and giving so generously of their time. I also want to thank Amy Jarman for a wonderful evening at her home. Where are you? Thank you, Amy. I also want to thank the graduate students in the workshop today for a lively and productive seminar. Tonight I'll read primarily from my new collection, Domain of Perfect Affection, and incorporate some work from The Horse Fair and All-American Girl and a couple of new poems. The New Egypt. I think of my father who believes a Jew can outwit fate by owning land. Slave to property now, I mow and mow. My destiny, the New Egypt. From his father, the tailor, he learned not to rent, but to own, to borrow, to buy. To conform, I disguise myself and drag the mower into the drive, where I ponder the silky oil, the plastic casing, the choke. From my father, I learned the dignity of exile and the fire of acquisition. Not to live in places lightly, but to plant the self like an orange tree in the desert and irrigate, irrigate. Irrigate. Dreaming at the Rexall Drug. in Wyoming at the confluence of Clear and Piney Creeks. I find myself watching low clouds mass above the Bighorns. If I were to get on this bicycle and ride to Buffalo, I'd saunter into the Rexall Drug and order a root beer float. I'd fill out a contest form to win a thoroughbred, as I did every week in my eighth year, in love with the bay in the plate glass window. In Buffalo, Wyoming, an America my Russian grandmother never imagined, we are standing before the cosmetics counter, and she is testing Revlon lipsticks to find the perfect shade of peach. I drift toward the comic books, where Lois Lane is repeatedly rescued and flies, past skyscrapers and suspension bridges, as I do in my dreams. My grandmother takes my hand and we walk. At the house, it's 1955, and my father has the thick black hair he lost before I was born. He leads us to the patio, where Chinese lanterns sway like soft paper crowns. All the neighbors I will grow to love are laughing and floating in the buoyant atmosphere. And here comes my mother in a party dress, holding my baby sister. I've not learned to read their faces for bankruptcy or grief. As far as I know, everyone will live forever. And little girls like me will continue to win racehorses from Rexall, where my grandmother will stand, twisting lipstick tubes, discovering one imperfect color after another. We talked a little bit in the workshop today about the title of the collection, and you'll hear it in this poem. It's called Salon. Acolyte at the font, my mother bends before basin and hose, where Jackie soaps her fine head, adjusting pressure and temperature. How many times has she bared her throat, her clavicle, beside the other old women? How many times the regular cleansing and surrender to the cold chair, the sink, the detergent, the lights, the slick of water down the nape? Turbaned and ready, she foregoes the tray of sliced bagels and donuts, a small private dignity. Vivian the manicurist dispels despair, takes my mother's old hands into her swift hands and softens them to soak in the cuticles before the rounding and shaping. As they talk, my mother attends to the lifelong business of revealing and withholding. Careful to frame each story while Vivian lacquers each nail and then inspects each slender finger, rubbing my mother's hands with the fragrant thin lotion, each summarizing her week, each condemning that which must be condemned, each celebrating the manicure and the tip. Sometimes in pain, sometimes broken with grief in the parking lot, my mother keeps her Friday appointment time, protected now by ritual and tradition. The fine cotton of Michael's white shirt brushes against her cheek as they stare into the mirror at one another. Ennobled by his gaze, she accepts her diminishment, she who knows herself his favorite. In their cryptic language, they confide and converse, his hands busy in her hair, her hands quiet in her lap. Barrel-chested Italian, a lover of opera, he husbands his money and his lover, Ethan. Only with him may she discuss my lover and me. And in this way, intimacy takes the shape of the afternoon she passes in the salon, in the domain of perfect affection. This is a poem I wrote for Maxine Cumin's husband, Victor Cumin. Maxine Cumin, of course, is a wonderful contemporary poet who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1973. She lives on a horse farm in New Hampshire. And I got to know her many years ago when I was teaching at MIT. And I began going up to her farm when I lived in Boston to help out with chores, and I got to know her husband, Victor. So this is a poem I wrote for him. It's called The Woodlot for Victor Cumin. In the farmhouse early morning, you review the list of chores tacked to the post. They vary by season, site, number of hands needed, number of trips, machinery, and vehicles. Tasks fall into invisible subcategories: the urgent, the accidental, the rock bound. We walk uphill. You're explaining citizenship, your passion for the civic work that builds a library, a community, a 200-year-old stone wall. We spend an hour stacking wood, a companionable chore, good for two, you tell me, never one alone. Alone, the stacker will grow careless, miss the log's listing tendency, forget to throw halves aside for supporting ends. You shim unsteady places as we go, selecting pieces for the trim, crisp line that gives us room for another row. You are love's year-round caretaker, and by your example, I understand the artfulness of love's responsibilities. There are many animals in my poems, all sorts of animals. You'll hear some of them, but the animal that is my kind of totem animal is the homely dog. And I have many dogs who appear in all sorts of ways. And this is one of my dog poems. It's called Okay, Tucker. Okay, Tucker, you win. My arm got tired of throwing the ball before you got tired of scrambling up the riverbank to fetch it. Okay, Tucker, you can come too. Since you opened the door with your clever snout, I'm not about to shove you back in. You win the beauty contest, the most finicky eater award, and the like a dog with a bone prize. You win the first one in the car sweepstakes. Look, Tucker, we had no choice when we squared off in your adolescence. We had to get along. It was a live and let live situation, both of us in love with her. Okay, I bribed you with biscuits and rides. You conned me with a handshake and a smile. Remember hide and seek in the cornfield, the jack in the pulpit, the lady's slipper, that week at the beach with smelly gulls wrapped in slime and tangled lines of seaweed and a pen of chickens. You had it made, but no. Old girl, you chased the phantom squirrel up the slope again and again, returned slack-jawed, refused to come off the porch, stood your ground in freezing November rain, showed your dog's teeth when I showed my human fear, and for good measure ran circles around me when I was her woman, but you were her dog. Late Butch Femme. Long accustomed to playing the butch, I saw you for the femme I thought you were, long-waisted, well-bred, the hostess who knew to fold the napkin in the wine glass. but I had not watched you square your shoulders before the arborist, determined to take down the holly to save the oak. No, you said, the pin oak goes, the holly stays. The gutter man who wants his check will have to repair the drain he botched. Please have your son call me, you say, your fingers ready for another call. In the cellar, among the foraged dressers, you measure and sand and strip. Come up for the lunch I made you, O handy lover, with your retractable blade, your small drill, your paintbrushes bristling. That was a sonnet. A love sonnet. How many people have tried to write a sestina in this class? Let's see those proud hands. Okay, good. This is a sestina from All American Girl. I think you'll get most of the references. So, for those people who haven't tried a sestina before, try and see if you can catch the six words with which every line ends in all of the stanzas, except for the last stanza, where of the six words, three appear in the middle and three appear at the end. Peter Pan in North America. Mary Martin, leader of the Lost Boys, when you flew across the stage in drag, in your tattered forest suit, teasing hook, some of us recognized you. Girl, boy, darling, you refused to grow into any version of manhood. While we cheered at the play in New York, 1960, tomboys pulled from play to put on dresses and sit among the feckless boys. Years later, we cultivated our baby butch versions of Peter before our mirrors. That day, we couldn't drag ourselves from our seats. You liked the play, darling? Our knowing mothers asked. We dangled from the hook of their question, the answer as overdetermined as hook's effeminate ways. Being a boy was best. Second best, we'd play Peter in school plays, flirt with our Wendy darlings, and strap on toy sabers like pirates taking lost boys hostage. After all, Mary Martin could fly, take a drag from a pipe, dance with her shadow, reject predictable versions of femaleness, call it chutzpah or perversion, we imagined ourselves, breasts bound, hooked to guy wires, smartly dressed in roguish drag. We took our own message from the play. If grown-up gendered roles awaited all girls and boys, then woe to her whom he called darling. When the time came, we called each other darling and fell into our own problematic diversions and girl-girl relations. Next door, the gay boys camped it up, swishing around in capes like hook. Now we've got adult cult artists to play the gender-bending game. We know the world needs drag queens, he-she's, and transvestites at the drag ball. Behind the hetero scrim, Mr. and Mrs. Darling, fly erotic creatures of every sexual preference who play havoc with your repressed aversions. Skirt and slip, tank and tights, drop the baited hook and we'll all bite. Girls, boys, everything in between. Drag revealed our own inversions long before the darlings were upstaged by hook, and grown-up play separated the Marys from the boys. What were the six words? Thank you. What were the words?
Version.
Version. Hook, which be, which becomes what?
Aversion.
Aversion, diversion, yeah.
Aversion.
Hook.
Play.
Play.
Drag.
Darling.
Drag.
Darling. Boys and darling. Oh, they all get an A. Very good. Talked a little bit today in workshop about found poems. How many people have tried found poems, poems made of things that you scavenged. Let's see. Some people, good, okay. So, several years ago at Penn State, I was working with a visual artist, and we were researching the history of the field of home economics, of all things, because we were studying the ways in which women had entered higher education in previous generations. And so if some of you were to speak to your grandmothers, you might find that some of them entered school through the College of Home Economics. And in fact, Penn State had a College of Home Economics. So we were researching our project and we came across some really interesting books. So this is a found poem. I lifted the text from the book, scrambled the sentences, and made this poem from somebody else's language. Everybody with me? Okay. The book is called Guide for Today's Home Living. I'll check the back and see when it was published. Guide for Today's Home Living. Which was published in 1966 by D.C. Heath and Company in Boston. It was written by, and one of them was a Penn State professor, Mildred Andrews and Hazel Hatcher. And it was used in home economics classes. So this is the poem, again, with the lifted text. I call it Qualities Boys Like Best in Girls. Boys like a girl who is alert, full of life, and fun to be with. She doesn't sit on the sidelines and expect to be entertained. A girl who shows friendliness and interest in others attracts boys. They like a girl who overlooks their faults and makes them feel at ease in embarrassing situations. A girl's appearance is important to boys. A pretty girl catches the eye. Poise, good posture, a sunny disposition, and a fresh, well-groomed look are characteristics boys admire. Hoping to make a more pleasing appearance by using cosmetics, a girl needs to know how to wear makeup without its being overdone or obvious. Punctuality is a trait that makes a hit with boys. A self-conscious boy is apt to feel ill at ease if he has to spend too long a time conversing with the girl's parents. Boys like a girl who is sincere. A girl who is straightforward appeals to boys. Boys dislike a girl who tries to make an impression by prattling on about how much things cost. Boys place a high value on loyalty, too. Boys prefer a girl who shows some intelligence. Who knows when to laugh and when to be serious, when to talk and when to listen. Boys like a girl who is modest about her accomplishments. They feel insecure when a girl gives the impression that she is mentally superior to them. I didn't write a word of it. I lifted it all. This is a funny thing to say, but this is the poem for which I received in my poetry career the largest payment. Where was it published? It was published in Slate. It's called Yoga. The teacher says to feel the breath flowing up the spine, up the neck, where the vertebrae click in the teeth of the ratchet wheel, where concentration forces spirit upward on the hinged paw of perfect self-control to the crown of the head. Next, the birds come with their bits of straw and fabric and thread. In the pose of the standing tree, I am a patient bodhisattva enduring a spring rain, content to forego enlightenment and be reborn again and again in the pose of the downward-facing dog, inhaling the fecund April earth with first one, then the other nostril, to practice the sacred shifting of consciousness from mind to mind. In this disciplined exchange of breath, we train for distance runs at altitude, incarnations as mountain cats or Asian trees, our life's breath finding a home in every metabolic niche. Elephant, lotus, monkey, banyan, we bend boughs and snouts, balancing the ineffable as it rolls and pitches out of these momentary bodies. I'm going to read two new poems. This is one of them. It's called A Short History of the End. Pre-renovation, down at the heels charming, the summer house you used to call Love Shack tested your patience, reminded you each weekend of all the work ahead. You'd lost your mother. Your job, like a hump on your back, bore down. Tired of sadness, I wanted joy and said so. And in the saying, refused to see or hear that you needed me to let you be, moody or silent, whatever. My ex had come to visit with her dog, a recent rescue, that combination of fearful and testy. After enduring 10 hours in the car, he curled into a tight knot beneath the table. I couldn't know our lives would change when you crawled near him and he leapt, startled from sleep, to gash your face, blood pouring from a rip beneath your eye. In shock, you stumbled from the house. We sat you down, held ice to the bite, tried to tell you it wasn't deep, would heal without a scar. Bright with fear, your eyes told me, no forgiveness. Though we tried, no kennel on Long Island had room for one more dog. Somehow, the weekend passed. Two. Our academic year commute began, renovations underway, the usual schedule of visits and plans. Dispiriting our long-distance intimacy of rushed phone calls and predictable narratives of similar days, I signed on to take the dog with my ex to obedience class, reform school for troubled dogs of every description, hapless cocker, brainy poodle, sidetracked shepherd, pointer, mutt, a dozen owners struggling with sit, stay, down, heel, the angry chihuahua in a tiny choke necklace of silver links, lunged for the Bernese mountain dog. The beagle kept wandering away, distracted by the breeze spinning autumn color around our motley crew. I grew fond of those Sunday afternoon ingatherings of misfits and the misbehaved. Hours an A student submitted to commands. And then I said I'd keep the dog for 5 months when my ex took work abroad. You couldn't believe I'd bring to bed your enemy or love a creature that had brought you harm. I think you left me then, affiliations tangled up then. Autumn Measure. Violence done to the body to save the body. Tomorrow my friend will leave the hospital without her breasts. We say, at least she has her life, her work, her legs. Fate's impersonal face looks back at me from every burning bush. The crack I hear isn't a bullet but another apple falling hard on the tin roof overhead. I'm reading this poem for Kate. It's another dog poem. How many people here have actually known a basset hound? I mean, really had a relationship with a basset hound? Only 3 people. Okay, good. In praise of the basset hound. This unlovely dog with warts and a terrible stink common to the breed, legless as a walrus, teaches me to pursue my life with devotion. Steadfast enthusiast of fisher cat and vole, she relies now almost entirely on scent and sings her hound song of pleasure when we come close enough for her to hear her name. In snow above her shoulder, she tracks our skis when all we can see is her metronome tail tipped in black, sweeping the horizon a mile back. We keep her incontinent in an old shed behind the farmhouse, a wire fence around her run. Warm days, nose in the air, she sits like an old retiree in the sun, listening to warblers build their spring nests. Her warts ooze, her eyes rain green phlegm. Still I kiss her and hold her against my breast, she who whelped 12 litters before someone took pity and bought her from the breeder. Never permitted to lick hand or face, she will not disgrace her training and extend her tongue in play, though I offer my cheek. Daily she shows me the meaning of character. Loping painfully on swollen paws, I apply salve to her scaly folds. I croon over her. Who among us has not been moved by the magnificence of mute creatures in their abundant dying skin? To understand this poem, you need to know that Kendall Central, Harvard, and Porter are the names of subway stops in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Okay. Sisters in Perpetual Motion. Urban wanderers, unhoused and unhinged. They are wrapped in a perpetual motion of paraphernalia, trundling from Kendall to Central, Harvard to Porter. One in a gentleman's greatcoat, worsted gabardine and fur collar, holds a sidebar conference with herself, pushes her metal shopping cart, argues with the invisible censorious judge of Massachusetts Avenue. Parallel to traffic, she retains a centrifugal relationship to the lanes she occupies, strides away from the main parent axis of rotation, abjures public transportation or charity, and returns early evening, cold, coincident with those of us not charged with a conundrum of streets. She sleeps in undocumented doorways and on grates and in neighborhood parks on benches and propped on soiled cushions she pushes. Sponge of pocked foam bedding, torn lining of a brown coat. Thus I remember my sister, her unbuilt days of compulsive walking before she decamped to clinics and psych wards. Her walkabouts, her unfettered speech, her terrorist phone calls, and the tyranny of her jurisdiction. Thus, beleaguered, she engineered a siege and won. Timber up a frame dwelling, I said. Explain yourself to yourself. In the end, the cops broke down the door of an empty house to find her. Two more poems. This poem's called Now. Now that I have the whole afternoon to myself, I can forget my 25-year plan of living on the Paros beach with friends as the school year begins. Now that the rain has moved inland, I can surrender the old Madison Square Garden dressage dream of perfect balance on a horse's back. Now that the forecast says clear weather through Friday, I can give up the dream that my parents lived to 120, still driving and doing their own grocery shopping. Now that I have 3 hours to spend before I go to the dump and leftovers with which to make a chicken sandwich, I can forego my dream of breeding standard poodles, though I like to picture many pens with black puppies sprawling over my groomed lawn, though a handsome poodle meets me at the door with a glass of white wine. Now that my neighbor has finished his mowing, I can hear myself think about death, how it occupies every living space I can imagine, though I can't hold the thought. Now that a breeze permits me to understand this day will not merge with others into a synopsis of the summer, now that I've gone this far, now that you've come with me, I can give up my dream of biking from Boston to San Francisco in a skin-tight jersey covered with ads. Mid-semester. Reciting the names of North American birds and whistling all the way to the Pacific. And I'll close with a poem. This poem is based on David Ferry's translation of Horace's odes. So it's an ode. It's called On Friendship After Horace. Come down, M. Stop sulking in that tree. If the contractor came late and the worker shingling the barn made a mistake, if the fuel tank in your truck's kaput, if your dead friend's dog won't eat her dinner, pluck a few raspberries from the October garden. Okay, so you have to dig up the dahlias. Still holding a grudge about that trip to Italy, our bad sex life after our good sex life? Darling, must we return to the Tigris and Euphrates? After 20 years of friendship, we're still lousy at talking to each other. Two middle-aged women in an age of non-potable water on Long Island. Lethal viruses housed offshore. The scallop harvest at record lows. Let me recommend Horace, who combined passion with a practical love for the snafu, who accepted the bungler, the perfectionist, the one who must have a pear-shaped glass with a narrow top for aromatic liquors. The two-faced, the evasive, the worried. Horace knew that friendship is neither intermittent nor divisible into parts, but aboriginal, discordant, the new music. M, come down from that tree and listen to the apples dropping on the tin roof. We've been friends since the cradle of civilization, a pair of foragers watching the deer at midnight sustain themselves on the rotten, the fallen. Thank you very much.
We're having a reception and a book signing down in the atrium. Go out this door and go left to where you see things happening. That's where we'll be.
look for the action.